the person who does not learn from the mistakes of history is doomed to repeat them. And I've heard a lot of people quoting that and changing the wording slightly, but it was in Spanish originally, so that might be a free translation. But the point is well made, isn't it? If you don't know anything about what happened in the past, you don't learn from the mistakes of history, you're likely to just walk into the same mistakes again. So, we're going to read Ezekiel chapter 20, and I'm not going to read it through and then preach on it. I'm going to read bits of it and then explain them and then read the next bit. I think that's probably the best way to tackle it. It's quite a long passage. So Ezekiel chapter 20, verse 1. In the seventh year, in the fifth month, on the tenth day, some of the elders of Israel came to inquire of the Lord, and they sat down in front of me. He means the seventh year of his exile. He'd been exiled with a lot of other people from Judah. This wasn't the final exile that took place with the destruction of Jerusalem a few years later, but it was a kind of intermediate exile. And he'd gone off with them into Babylonia. And the seventh year would be 591 BC. And some of the elders came to inquire of the Lord, which, as I said just now, means they must have recognized that here was a man of God who was likely to be able to give to them a message from the Lord, even though they were slightly perplexed about some of the things he said and the way he did it. They expected to hear the word of God through him. Here are the civic leaders of a community coming to a religious man expecting to hear the word of God through him. Bit of a challenge for us, that, isn't it? Do our contemporaries, our fellow countrymen, civic leaders, expect to hear the word of God through the church? What kind of a reception did Rowan Williams get a couple of weeks back when he ventured to comment on the political life of the country? Rather a negative reaction from some of the politicians themselves. Almost saying, well, what right have you to tell us what to do? You're just a religious leader. And do people expect to hear the word of God from us, our friends? Do they come to us thinking, well, we have a special privileged access to God, understanding of his ways and his word, and they expect to hear something from us that will be interesting and important? That's a challenge, isn't it? Or do some of our friends and contemporaries just dismiss us as irrelevant and say, well, they don't know anything. They know even less than we do about current affairs, and we're not interested in their religion. Anyway, that's something to think about. Verse 2, then the word of the Lord came to me. Son of man, speak to the elders of Israel and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. Have you come to inquire of me? As surely as I live, I will not let you inquire of me, declares the sovereign Lord. That's interesting reaction, isn't it, that Ezekiel voices on behalf of God. No, I'm not going to let you inquire of me. But actually, the whole chapter is full of a message from God. So it is a bit contrary, isn't it? But what I think what the Lord is saying is, if you're just coming to me because you're kind of curious about what might happen in the future, I'm not going to give you that kind of message. But I will give you a piece of my mind. I will tell you what for. And really, that's what the chapter's full of. And this history lesson that the Lord gives through Ezekiel begins with the book of Exodus. Verse 4, will you judge them? Will you judge them, son of man? This is the Lord speaking to Ezekiel. Then confront them with the detestable practices of their fathers and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. On the day I chose Israel, I swore with uplifted hand to the descendants of the house of Jacob and revealed myself to them in Egypt. With uplifted hand, I said to them, I am the Lord your God. On that day, I swore to them that I would bring them out of Egypt into a land I had searched out for them, a land flowing with milk and honey, the most beautiful of all lands. And I said to them, each of you get rid of the vile images you have set your eyes on, and do not defile yourselves with the idols of Egypt. I am the Lord your God. God made a covenant with his people, a covenant through Moses. And the covenant involved God making a promise to them, I will bring you out of slavery in Egypt, I will bring you to the promised land, and you will be my people. But for their part, the people had responsibilities in this covenant. They were to turn their backs on idolatry. And that requirement is set out in the Ten Commandments, in Commandments 2 and 3. You shall have no other gods besides me, and you shall not make graven images of God. Two commandments against idolatry, against having other gods. That was the covenant. But as we know, they soon broke these commandments. They soon broke the commandment about idolatry, that's for sure. And notably in the incident of the golden calf, you remember when Moses was up the mountain, the people came to Aaron, his brother, and said, we don't know what's happened to this Moses, but would you please make for us a nice golden calf that we can worship, and then that can be our God. And so Aaron foolishly agreed to do what they said, so he asked them to bring along all their gold jewelry. They cast it into a golden image, and they bowed down to it and they worshipped it. Exactly what they were told that they shouldn't do, to make graven images of God. So this is the beginning of the history lesson. God made a gracious covenant with his people, but they immediately broke it. And of course, idolatry characterized their life, their religious life, throughout the next few centuries. It wasn't just that one incident. Verse 8, but they rebelled against me and would not listen to me. They did not get rid of the vile images they'd set their eyes on, nor did they forsake the idols of Egypt. So I said I would pour out my wrath on them and spend my anger against them in Egypt. But for the sake of my name, I did what would keep it from being profaned in the eyes of the nations they lived among, and in whose sight I had revealed myself to the Israelites by bringing them out of Egypt. Therefore I led them out of Egypt and brought them into the desert. I gave them my decrees and made known to them my laws, for the man who obeys them will live by them. Also I gave them my Sabbaths as a sign between us, so they would know that I, the Lord, made them holy. Ezekiel singles out the Sabbath law. For him, that was very important. It was one of the Ten Commandments, and it's got the obvious practical purpose for giving people rest, and that must have sounded very attractive to the people of Israel when they'd been slaves for generations in Egypt, and they probably never had any rest. So to be given a day of rest would have sounded wonderful, so it's got that obvious purpose. But Ezekiel points out it's got another purpose. It's got another very special significance, the Sabbath, because it sets apart the people of God as his holy people. Verse 12, I gave them my Sabbaths as a sign between us, so they would know that I, the Lord, made them holy. Holy. They're set apart as his special people, and the Sabbath is a sign of that. A sign for themselves, to remind them, a sign for the surrounding nations who watch them and see the way they live. Ah, they do that because they're the people of God. And that's quite challenging for us, I think, isn't it? Things have changed now. We don't call it the Sabbath, well, some people perhaps do. What we call today the Lord's Day. The day was changed by the early church to the first day of the week, because this is the day on which Jesus rose from the dead. But it's still got some of that same significance. And people still watch us. And people still see us getting into our cars with our Bibles in our hands. And they know we're going off to church. And it sets us apart as the Lord's people, as a holy people. And it's important. And so really that should help us as we think about how we spend the Lord's day. What do we do with it? Yet the people of Israel rebelled against me in the desert. They did not follow my decrees, but rejected my laws, although the man who obeys them will live by them, and they utterly desecrated my Sabbaths. So I said I would pour out my wrath on them and destroy them in the desert. But for the sake of my name, I did what would keep it from being profaned in the eyes of the nations in whose sight I had brought them out. Also, with uplifted hand, I swore to them in the desert that I would not bring them into the land I had given them, a land flowing with milk and honey, most beautiful of all lands, because they rejected my laws and did not follow my decrees and desecrated my Sabbaths, for their hearts were devoted to their idols. Yet I looked on them with pity and did not destroy them or put an end to them in the desert. I said to their children in the desert, do not follow the statutes of your fathers or keep their laws or defile yourselves with their idols. I am the Lord your God. Follow my decrees and be careful to keep my laws. Keep my Sabbaths holy, that they may be a sign between us. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God. An interesting paragraph, that, because what it says there is God is saying through Ezekiel, there were times when I thought I would destroy the people. I nearly did it. But for one or two reasons, I didn't do it. And it's interesting, if you look in that passage, there's more than one reason given why he didn't destroy them. In verse 14, it says, for the sake of my name, I did what would keep it from being profaned in the eyes of the nations in whose sight I had brought them out. There's a reason. God says, I didn't destroy my chosen people, because if I had, I would have been laughed at. My name would have been profaned. The nations would have known that I'd brought the people out of Egypt and I'd chosen them and made a covenant with them. If I'd destroyed them, the nations would have said, well, who's this God then? If he can't even manage to bring them into the promised land. So he says, for the sake of my name, to keep it from being profaned, I didn't destroy them. But of course, there is another reason why he didn't destroy them. He says he took pity on them. And that's a nice reason, isn't it? He loved them, basically. He took pity on them, and that's why he didn't destroy them. And while we're thinking about, well, why didn't God destroy the people in the desert, we shouldn't underrate the influence of Moses. There were times when Moses came before God as an intercessor on behalf of the people, like after the incident of the golden calf. And Moses came before God in prayer and he said, well, we've done an awful thing, Lord. This lot are a total rabble and you're quite entitled to destroy them, but please don't. Take me if you like. Destroy me, but please don't destroy them. And that's a real intercession, isn't it? Putting yourself in the place of the people who are actually under threat. And Moses was a great intercessor. And the Lord said to him on that occasion, all right then, I won't. And I'm not going to destroy you, he said. Whoever has sinned, I will destroy. But not you. I need you. Verse 21. But the children rebelled against me. They did not follow my decrees. They were not careful to keep my laws, although the man who obeys them will live by them. And they desecrated my Sabbaths. So I said I would pour out my wrath on them and spend my anger against them in the desert. But I withheld my hand. And for the sake of my name, I did what would keep it from being profaned in the eyes of the nations in whose sight I had brought them out. Also, with uplifted hand, I swore to them in the desert that I would disperse them among the nations and scatter them through the countries because they had rejected my laws. They had not obeyed my laws, but had rejected my decrees and desecrated my Sabbaths, and their eyes lusted after their father's idols. I also gave them over to statutes that were not good, and laws that they could not live by. I let them become defiled through their gifts, the sacrifice of every firstborn, that I might fill them with horror, so that they would know that I am the Lord. This is a dreadfully difficult paragraph, isn't it? What God is saying is basically, I let them get on with it and do awful things, even sacrificing their children. Why? Sometimes God gives people over to do things that are contrary to his will. Sometimes he doesn't step in and stop them. And Ezekiel specifically mentions the sacrifice of every firstborn. Now, human sacrifice was a very common thing in the ancient world at that time. If you'd come to Britain then, you would have found people sacrificing human beings. We're told that by the classical writers, like Julius Caesar, for example. And they weren't exceptional. This was going on all over the place. It was going on in Canaan, the promised land, where the people were going to come. And when they got there, they watched it happening, and they probably thought, oh, well, if that's what you're supposed to do, we'll do that. Of course, there's reference to this in the story of the Passover, isn't there? Because at the time when firstborn are being killed, the Lord says through Moses to the people, now, I don't want you to kill your firstborn, but you have to dedicate them to me. Therefore, in order to save them from being killed, you will have to redeem them. And so they were redeemed with a payment of silver. They didn't kill them. But obviously there was a kind of a mixed up mentality about this, even amongst the people of Israel. They knew they'd been told to redeem the firstborn with money, but they saw the nations around them killing them, and they thought, well, that's probably better to do that. That's better than just giving some money. So that's what we should do. But the commandment not to do it is repeated time and time again, and Leviticus 18:2 is an example where it says, do not give any of your children to be sacrificed to Molech, which is one of the gods, one of the Canaanite gods. Mustn't do it. Don't do it. The Lord hates it. So why did he let them do it then? Why does God let us do bad things? And I mean, it's a general question, isn't it? It's not just to do with human sacrifice. Why does God let you do bad things? Why does God let me do bad things? Why doesn't he step in and stop us and make us do the right thing? And the only explanation that seems possible is that, as far as God is concerned, our freedom is so important, it's such a high value, that he's not prepared to override it and make us do what he wants us to do. He's not prepared to make us into robots, in other words. He's determined to preserve our free will, our freedom, even though he's horrified by the things that we do with it. And we can think of loads of examples. You may have seen it on the television. I saw it a couple of years ago. There was a play called God on Trial, which is set in the time of the Holocaust, and there's a bunch of Jewish people in a concentration camp, and they know they're likely to be killed soon, But they get talking and they decide to organise like a courtroom trial in their hut where they're being kept and put God on trial. And they have a prosecution counsel and a defence counsel, and the prosecution counsel, basically his argument is God needs to be put on trial because of all that he's allowed to happen, including the Holocaust, including the massacre of all these millions of Jews. And the defence counsel obviously does his best, and they have a very interesting debate about this issue. Can we really justify God, if you like, for the way he organises things, and the way, particularly the way he allows human beings to do bad things without stepping in and stopping them? And as I say, the only explanation that seems at all plausible is that from God's point of view, human freedom is so important that he's not prepared to override it. He's determined to allow us to have freedom, free will, even though he knows what bad things we might do with it. It's a tough one, that passage. And I've made some notes for the house groups, for some of the house groups are studying Ezekiel with us. And I should imagine you'll have an interesting time of it discussing that question. Verse 27, therefore, son of man, speak to the people of Israel and say to them, this is what the sovereign Lord says. In this also your fathers blasphemed me by forsaking me. When I brought them into the land I had sworn to give them, and they saw any high hill or any leafy tree, they offered their sacrifices, made offerings that provoked me to anger, presented their fragrant incense and poured out their drink offerings. When I said to them, what is this high place you go to? It is called Bama to this day. Bama is just the Hebrew for high place. After the people had settled into the promised land, there was obviously an issue about where is the correct place to worship God and to offer sacrifices. And in order to maintain right teaching and practice, the worship needed to focus on the tabernacle to start with, and then after they'd built the temple replaced the tabernacle, and worship was focused there. But there was a constant tendency amongst the people to set up high places in lots of different locations around the country, and to ignore the temple in Jerusalem. Oh, we've got a hill here, let's go up this hill. We can put a little altar up there and worship God there. And the problem with that, of course, is it carried the risk that the people would include in their worship all the Canaanite practices of the people who'd lived in the land before they arrived. If they were free to just go up to the nearest hill and put a stone altar up there, they could get on with doing all sorts of things that the Canaanites did, including child sacrifice, including ritual prostitution, which was a part of the Canaanite religion, a kind of fertility cult. And the people would have been tempted to do all those things if they'd been allowed to worship wherever they liked. For us, perhaps as we think about, well, what relevance has that got to us? I think the issue is, how important is it that there is a kind of central guarantee of orthodoxy, of right teaching? Is it important for us? Now, if we were Roman Catholics, we would have a quick answer to that question, wouldn't we? We'd say, well, we've got a central guarantee of orthodoxy. We've got a pope, and occasionally he makes pronouncements ex cathedra from his chair, and we're obliged to regard those pronouncements as infallible. It doesn't happen very often, but in between those pronouncements you've got the Congregation for the Maintenance of the Faith, and that keeps guard over theology teaching in all the universities, all the books that are published, and make sure that they toe the line with orthodoxy. And of course, Joseph Ratzinger, who's the present pope, was the head of that organization before he was promoted, the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. So it's an easy question, easy answer if you're a Roman Catholic. But when the Reformation took place, the Protestants thought, now this is a bad thing to have all this authority centralized in one body like that, because if a body of Christians get a kind of fresh inspiration and enthusiasm and a new understanding of the Bible, it's likely to get trampled on by this central authority. And of course, that's what happened to Martin Luther when he got his new insights. They did try and trample on him, and he was excommunicated and had to go into hiding. And so the Protestants said, no, it's a bad thing to have the authority centralized so much. I guess, being Protestants, we're probably on the side of the Protestants in the Reformation. We think, well, they did the right thing. But we can see why the Catholics, the Roman Catholics, would have been so afraid of what happened. Oh dear, if we start letting people read the Bible for themselves and make their own mind up about what it means, we're going to have all sorts of heresies spreading like wildfire. And that's the same as the fear that Ezekiel is expressing here. He's saying, well, if you can go up to any old high place, wherever you like, you can make up what you do and make up what you teach, and there's no authority. Where do we stand on that one? There's one very interesting ray of light that can be shed on this question, and that's the teaching of Jesus. When he was speaking to the woman at the well in Samaria, she said, whereabouts should we worship God then? Do you have to go to Jerusalem, where you Jews go, or would it be okay to go to Mount Gerizim, where we Samaritans worship? You know what Jesus said? He said, woman, I tell you, the hour is already here when those who worship God will worship in spirit and in truth, neither on this mountain nor on that mountain. Doesn't matter, in other words, where you worship. And that's probably the right position. But I do understand the concern that, for example, the Roman Catholics had at the Reformation, thinking that things were just going to degenerate into total chaos. As soon as you allow all sorts of people to believe what they want. I suppose in a sense they were right. Things did degenerate into a lot of diversity, didn't they? Another question to discuss in the house groups. Verse 30, therefore say to the house of Israel, this is what the sovereign Lord says, will you defile yourselves the way your fathers did and lust after their vile images? When you offer your gifts, the sacrifice of your sons in the fire, you continue to defile yourselves with all your idols to this day. Am I to let you inquire of me, O house of Israel? As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, I will not let you inquire of me. You say, we want to be like the nations, like the peoples of the world who serve wood and stone. But what you have in mind will never happen. As surely as I live, declares the sovereign Lord, I will rule over you with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm and with outpoured wrath. I will bring you from the nations and gather you from the countries where you have been scattered. With a mighty hand and an outstretched arm and with outpoured wrath, I will bring you into the desert of the nations, and there, face to face, I will execute judgment upon you. As I judged your fathers in the desert of the land of Egypt, so I will judge you, declares the sovereign Lord. I will take note of you as you pass under my rod, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant. I will purge you of those who revolt and rebel against me, although I will bring them out of the land where they are living, yet they will not enter the land of Israel. Then you will know that I am the Lord. Ezekiel concludes the history lesson by saying that his contemporaries are just as bad as their forefathers, but God is not going to abandon them. He is going to bring them out of the places where they're captives, and he's going to hold a tribunal in the desert to purge out the evildoers. I will bring you into the desert of the nations, and there face to face I will execute judgment upon you. As I judged your fathers in the desert of the land of Egypt, so I will judge you, declares the Sovereign Lord. I will take note of you as you pass under my rod, and I will bring you into the bond of the covenant. That's an interesting phrase, isn't it? I will bring you into the bond of the covenant. It's got a severe sound to it, that, hasn't it? We probably think of God's covenant as being a very positive thing. It's about his love for us and his choosing us. But the covenant also implies discipline. It implies responsibility. That was true for the Israelites. It's also true for us. We're not supposed to take God's grace in vain. We're not supposed to take it for granted. Paul wrestled with this question in the letter to the Romans because people were saying to him, the gospel you're preaching suggests that people can please themselves and do what they like because they'll always be forgiven. And Paul tackles that one in the letter to the Romans, and he says, what shall we say then? Shall we go on sinning so that grace may increase? By no means. We died to sin. How can we live in it any longer? So the covenant is not there for us to take it for granted and think we can do what we like. It implies responsibility on our part. Verse 39, as for you, O house of Israel, this is what the Sovereign Lord says. Go and serve your idols, every one of you, but afterwards you will surely listen to me and no longer profane my holy name with your gifts and idols. For on my holy mountain, the high mountain of Israel, declares the Sovereign Lord, there, in the land, the entire house of Israel will serve me, and there I will accept them. There I will require your offerings and your choice gifts, along with all your holy sacrifices. I will accept you as fragrant incense when I bring you out of the nations and gather you from the countries where you've been scattered. And I will show myself holy among you in the sight of the nations. Then you will know that I am the Lord when I bring you into the land of Israel, the land I had sworn with uplifted hand to give to your fathers. There you will remember your conduct and all your actions by which you have defiled yourselves, and you will loathe yourselves for all the evil you have done. You will know that I am the Lord when I deal with you for my name's sake and not according to your evil ways and your corrupt practices, O house of Israel, declares the Sovereign Lord. It finishes off with quite a nice positive note, doesn't it, this history lesson. Ezekiel says that God is promising that the entire house of Israel will then serve him. On my holy mountain, the high mountain of Israel, declares the Sovereign Lord, there in the land, the entire house of Israel will serve me, and there I will accept them. That's a nice way to finish, really, looking forward to the possibility that the entire house of Israel will serve the Lord on his holy mountain, that's in Jerusalem. You could say, well, that sounds a bit optimistic, really, from Ezekiel's point of view. Saying that in captivity in Babylonia, it's a very positive and optimistic thing to say. But in fact, the people of Israel did go home from captivity in a remarkable, wonderful way. The nation that conquered Babylon, the Persians, their king, Cyrus, had a different policy to the policy of Nebuchadnezzar and the Babylonian rulers, and he decided to send the people home. And he told the people of Judah to go back to Judah to rebuild the city, to rebuild the temple. And the Jews became, if anything, a more decidedly monotheistic people. There was far less idolatry around after the exile, and more committed to the Sabbath probably as well, and the religion tended towards what we now think of as Judaism, the religion that Jesus would have encountered with the Pharisees and the scribes, etc. Some good things about that, some bad things about that, but certainly monotheistic, certainly obeying the Sabbath, and that's the sort of thing that Ezekiel is looking forward to. Ups and downs. Ezekiel, the history teacher, telling the people, look back, see what's happened, see the way you've sometimes had some good times, but there's been a lot of disobedience, a lot of unfaithfulness. But the Lord ultimately has a positive purpose for you. And I think we can apply that to a certain extent as well, with a certain amount of reservation and caution. But we can look back over Christian history, can't we, and see ups and downs and times of revival. And the very last question that I put on the house group notes is, are there any grounds for optimism that we can look forward to a time of revival in the Christian church in our own day? So I think that probably will result in a bit of interesting discussion.